loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, we talk about the increasing division in the Democratic Party over acknowledgement of the influence of the Israeli lobby. Next, we hear from a journalist who was surveilled and targeted by the U.S. government on a list of many who had been to the U.S.-Mexico border. Then the Trump administration is rolling back required reporting of civilians killed by drone strikes. And then the Federal Reserve is rolling back regulations on big banks that were instituted after the financial crash. And finally, our regular Veterans for Peace segment is about the looming danger of nuclear war.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. Former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort was in court for sentencing today. Manafort was found guilty of several crimes relating to financial fraud. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau gave a press conference today to address the growing scandal engulfing his administration over his alleged efforts to assist engineering giant SNC-Lavalin. Trudeau is accused of inappropriately pressuring the former attorney general to defer a criminal prosecution of the firm for bribery. At today's press conference, Trudeau admitted that he had, quote, made mistakes, but denied any illegality. Chinese telecommunications corporation Huawei filed a lawsuit against the U.S. government today in the district court in Plano, Texas, where the company has a headquarters. Huawei is challenging the new federal policy prohibiting government agencies and contractors from using its products. The lawsuit alleges that the policy violates the company's right to due process. A car bombing took place in the Somali capital Mogadishu today, killing at least seven. The explosion occurred outside a restaurant near a presidential guard checkpoint. The country is in the midst of a long-running insurgency, principally conducted by the terrorist group Al-Shabaab. Those are today's headlines. You are listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to Capitol Hill. The fallout from Representative Ilhan Omar's recent comments about foreign intervention in U.S. politics, interpreted as a reference to pro-Israel lobbying giant AIPAC, continued to broaden yesterday. Presidential candidates Bernie Sanders and Kamala Harris both backed Omar's right to her political position, and senior Democrats pushed back against House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's decision to offer a resolution, which at first condemned anti-Semitism and then condemned all religious intolerance. Senior Democrats are now debating whether there is a need for any resolution at all. We're joined from Washington by Ariel Gold. She's a peace activist and the national co-director of Code Pink. Welcome back, Ariel.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Just a few minutes ago, Steny Hoyer, the majority leader in the House, told colleagues that there would be a vote, but that this thing is going to be so broad that it's going to condemn all racial and ethnic and religious intolerance. So why have a vote anyway in the first place? How can you be against something like that? Doesn't it defeat the whole purpose?
Well, we know however they change the wording, and I do want to say it is thanks to enormous and incredible grassroots work.
That's important.
Ilhan,
yes.
That it was changed, but still the intention of it, given the timing and given the story, we've all watched this story. It is a rebuke of Ilhan Omar, and it falsely claims that what she said was anti-Semitic when it absolutely wasn't.
It was not. I mentioned the other day that Phyllis Bennis, who's a senior fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, well known in the Washington area as an expert on the Middle East, and she happens to be Jewish as well, said that she was sitting there 6 feet away from Ilhan Omar when she made her comments and that there was nothing anti-Semitic about them. They've been misconstrued. They've been politicized. They were not offensive.
Well, I was sitting about 8 feet away as well, right near Phyllis. And absolutely, you know, this is such a clear attack on Ilhan, on the first Black Muslim congresswoman. And, you know, one of the ways that I really see it is that in the last couple years, more and more Democrats are moving away from support for Israel. Polls show that. They show that when polls are taken, that Democrats used to largely say that they sympathized with Israelis, and now they sympathize with the Palestinian struggle more and more. Those numbers are continuing to change. We see these rapid, rapid changes, especially among young American Jews. You know, we have groups like If Not Now, and we have, again, these polls that show that American Jews are more and more disillusioned, especially young Jews, with Israel. And so, you know, the forces of the status quo, the pro-occupation forces, which are not only Jewish, it's not only Chuck Schumer. We all remember that very first piece of legislation introduced during the government shutdown, not by Schumer. Schumer, in fact, voted no twice on it because of the shutdown, so not to totally get him off the hook, but by Rubio, not a Jew. And if that isn't allegiance to a foreign government, I don't know what is.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. What about this notion that Nancy Pelosi needed to or wanted to punish somehow Ilhan Omar? You said a minute ago that the reason this thing is falling apart for the Democratic leadership in the House is because of grassroots support. I think that is exactly right. We've seen progressive activists from all over the country rally to her support. And now important Democrats, people like Kamala Harris, people like Bernie Sanders, have rallied to her side too. Is that going to force this issue away? Are we done with this now?
Well, we're certainly not done with this. We know that these, you know, when people get more and more backed into a corner, like I said, the forces of the status quo, that they get uglier and uglier. So I'd say we need to stay more and more vigilant. And still, we'd like this resolution to be dissolved entirely. But I just want to push back a little bit on one thing. You mentioned Kamala Harris, and yeah. I'm so glad that she came out with, you know, with Sanders, one of the 2020 candidates, but she has a lot to answer for herself.
Oh boy, does she.
So Kamala Harris has attended AIPAC for at least the last 2 years in a row. Last year, while speaking at AIPAC, while speaking to a group of around 3,500 students, when asked where her support for Israel comes from, she said the march from Selma to Montgomery is what inspires her to be committed to the U.S.-Israel relationship. She, in 2017, went on a trip to Israel, and we have a picture of her smiling with Benjamin Netanyahu that he tweeted out, a war criminal who has just built an alliance with the Jewish KKK, which Kamala has not condemned. So I want to say that you know, she's not off the hook herself.
Yeah.
Wow.
Sorry, I think I kind of took it another direction.
No, that's okay. That's okay.
She was also getting donations from Trump in, as late as 2013.
13. That's
Kamala
right.
Harris. Anyway,
that's right. She took money from Trump. And
so this might be a change, and maybe this is a show that she's going to start having to move. And I'd love to see that.
Yeah, I would too. But the thing for me personally is never trust a former prosecutor.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about what Ilhan Omar actually said. Let's talk about what she said, because it's a much longer part of a response to a question. And it's very, if anybody has the time to read it, you can go to the Institute for Policy Studies and read the full transcript. I'm sure it's other places.
It's on Code Pink's website.
Code
as
Pink.
Well.
There is nothing anti-Semitic about it. The thing that Nancy Pelosi and the other Democratic Party leaders seized on were these comments, which come about halfway through her longer comment. So for me, this is Ilhan Omar talking. For me, I want to talk about the political influence in this country that says it's okay for people to push for allegiance to a foreign country. And I ask, why is it okay for me to talk about the influence of the NRA, a fossil fuel industries, or big pharma, and not talk about a powerful lobby that is influencing policy? And I want to ask the question, why is it okay for you to push, for you to be there? There are so many people. I mean, most of us are new, but many members of Congress have been there forever. Some of them have been there before we were born. So I know many of them were fighting for people to be free, for people to live in dignity in South Africa. I know many of them fight for people around the world to have dignity, to have self-determination. So I know that they care about these things. So what she's basically then ripped apart for by Nancy Pelosi and the others is the old style mythology that if Jewish people are Americans or belong to any other nation, that they would have a divided loyalty because they would still be fundamentally loyal to a foreign agent, in this instance, the state of Israel. But that's not what she's saying at all. She's talking about the fact that there really is a major powerful lobby that's working on behalf of Israel that wields enormous influence in Washington. And Ariel, as we all know, anybody who stands up for or speaks out on behalf of Palestinian rights is labeled by the same lobby as anti-Semitic, thus conflating Jewishness or Jewish people with the state of Israel in a particular odious apartheid policy, as if you condemn apartheid, you're thus condemning Jews. I mean, that's kind of what it boils down to, which, of course, is not the case.
Absolutely. And if anything, you know, I took it as her talking about Marco Rubio. So he's not Jewish with a dual loyalty. He has his loyalty to Israeli. I mean, it's not a Jewish dual loyalty. He has a dual loyalty, a loyalty to Israel. But it's not because of him being Jewish. There's no trope being invoked there. This is because of political power and influence. It's because of all kinds of things.
That's absolutely right. And it's not just Rubio, too. You remember it was Schumer who bragged the day that Trump announced that the embassy was moving from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. It was Schumer who bragged that he was the one who got Trump to do it.
Yeah, I brought up Rubio because Rubio is not Jewish.
Right, right.
But absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think we also want to look at, you know, Omar is constantly accused of singling out Israel, but she doesn't single out Israel. She was the first and boldest of all of the members of Congress to come out against the U.S.-backed coup in Venezuela. She is constantly working hard to end U.S. support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen. We all remember her incredible grilling of war criminal Elliot Abrams.
Yes, indeed.
There's no singling out of Israel here.
That's a good point.
Yeah, she's taking progressive positions that oppose the dominant narrative in the Washington establishment.
And then the Washington establishment press runs these breathless articles saying that Nancy Pelosi and her top advisors are huddled behind closed doors to figure out how to deal with Ilhan Omar. There's no reason to change Ilhan Omar's position or her rights to say what her positions are.
Yeah, you're right, John. And Ariel, why do you think Nancy Pelosi and the other leaders leapt into action to try to censor her? Why did they do it?
Well, I think it is, you know, it's an attempt to keep the status quo. And it's an enormous amount of pressure. And in fact, in this case, we know exactly where the pressure came from. It was the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, which claims to be a civil rights organization while actually being involved in spying on activists in places like Ferguson, is directly involved in Islamophobic trainings in cities and for police forces, and is behind many of the times that U.S. police forces are sent over to Israel to train with the Israeli military to bring the tactics of vile occupation back and racism back here to our streets in America, and to teach Israeli soldiers about the vile racism that America was built on.
This is a story that is not over yet. We were joined from Washington by Ariel Gold. She's a peace activist and the national co-director of Code Pink. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Leaked documents reveal that five different federal agencies have been maintaining a secret database to target and track journalists, activists, and attorneys working on the recent migrant caravan heading toward the United States. The program, dubbed Operation Secure Line, resulted in the journalists and others being harassed at the U.S.-Mexico border, detained, and in some cases denied entry into Mexico. We're joined from San Diego by Ariana Dressler. She's a photojournalist who recently completed a series on migrants and asylum seekers at the border. And during this time, she was one of the many journalists and immigration advocates who was tracked, targeted, and interviewed. Welcome to the show, Ariana.
Thanks for having me on.
Ariana, I was frankly surprised to read this, not because this isn't what the government does. Of course, this is what the government does. But this story was broken by local affiliates of NBC. First of all, tell us how you realized you were being watched, being surveilled, being harassed, and then what happened?
Well, NBC actually notified me almost 2 weeks ago that I was on this list.
Ah.
So I was pretty shocked and a little upset because you know, on the cover page, it says, it mentions instigators. You know, I'm just trying to do my job along with other journalists. So I was a little upset. But I was only questioned in secondary three times. And the three times that I was questioned, CBP wanted to know what the mood in the shelters were like and what I was seeing on the ground. They kept saying that I was there, they weren't.
Right.
Questioned me a little bit about... Yeah,
the good cops.
Yeah, exactly.
they were just curious. They were just curious.
Yeah, they were. by the second time, after the second time, I felt a little bit like I was an informant with some of the questions. But I want to state that I also know that they have a job to do, and I know it's not easy. And so I have no problems with being questioned. But what I do have an issue with is if notebooks are searched, or laptops, phones, because we have sources to protect.
Sure.
But I haven't had an issue with that, but I know others have.
Oh, others have?
Yeah, others have. I've had notebooks looked at, phones. Yeah, so, but I can't speak to them, so I can only speak for myself.
Brian, there was a recent incident here in the Washington area where the Department of Education, which has its own police force, much to my surprise, did a 6 a.m. raid on the home of a Department of Education employee, saying that this employee had sensitive documents that he had taken home. He's married to a Reuters journalist, and they took her laptop and they took some files out of her den, her study. She had nothing to do with the Department of Education, of course, but it was a way for them to go through her media and see who her sources were.
Yeah, and there is this thing called the First Amendment.
Indeed.
Which is, you know, that journalists are not supposed to be targeted as enemy combatants or, you know, in sort of an enforced, like the role that Ariana was mentioning, like almost having to function as informants. Yeah, the government and the agencies that are at the border have a job to do. But on the other hand, this seems illegal to me. I mean, this is a secret spying operation against journalists and then having them pay a price for it. Again, because they were doing their jobs. Ariana, go ahead.
Oh, I mean, like I said before, I have no problem being questioned. It just becomes an issue when things get searched and looked at. And I feel like it is a gray area as far as what CBP can and can't do. I feel like there is a gray area. And yeah, I'm still, you know, learning myself. So it is a bit frustrating.
The three times that you were questioned by CBP, Ariana, did they ask you the same questions or were they different questions?
Some of them were the same. Some of them were different. Asking about if I could identify any Antifa people that were on the ground in Tijuana. Asking about my time in Syria briefly. They just wanted to know who I was there with when I was photographing, wanting to know who I was working for at the time. Just questions about, you know, freelance work. And so, I mean, they were different somewhat, but a lot of similar questions were about the shelters and what the mood was like and what I was seeing.
Well, let's talk about that if we could. What were the conditions like in the shelter? What were you observing? How does it, you know, based on your other coverage as a journalist, was it a kind of thing that you see elsewhere? Was it unique? Was it distinctive? What were you witnessing?
So I covered the caravan in April as well. So what I was seeing, what was different was the conditions. They were awful. At Benito Juarez, you had people, I mean, you had thousands of people sleeping pretty much on top of each other. People were showering outside in the mud and, you know, cars could see them while they're showering. People in the shelter could see people while they're showering. The toilets were right next to the showers. There was water on the ground that was not sanitary. I mean, it was pretty awful. And people were sick. People were coughing everywhere. You know, it's not like people are traveling about 2,000 miles for this kind of vacation. You know, it's a little ridiculous.
Yeah, indeed. And those are the kind of images in the photos and the story that is so important for people to hear because really the people on the caravan were treated more or less as a political football. In some cases, they were just used as a punching bag more than a football. But the kind of the human side of the story is, in fact, what we need independent journalists to provide. That's part of the reason it's also for John and I, you know, we find it very disturbing that the government is treating journalists like perhaps like the enemy, because maybe it'll discourage other journalists from doing the kind of thing that you've been doing because they don't want to be put on a government list.
Yeah, I mean, it is concerning, but I will tell you that it's going to take a lot more to stop me to photograph, you know, stories. So that's not going to stop me.
Yeah, and again, what's the now that the story is out, Ariana? Are you hearing from a lot of people, or is there a general interest in this? I mean, what's the feedback?
I am. I'm hearing from a lot of people. But I also, once this story dies down, I don't want to take away from it from the asylum seekers. Because, I mean, yeah, it's unfortunate and it sucks to be on a list. But guess what? I mean, I have a roof over my head. I'm not running from anything. You know, I don't have to provide for a family to make sure that they're going to be safe. So I definitely don't want to take away from that as well. You know, that's important, if not more, than being on a list to me.
We are speaking from San Diego with Ariana Dressler. She's a photojournalist who recently completed a series on migrants and asylum seekers at the U.S.-Mexico border. And during that time, she was one of the many journalists and immigration advocates who was tracked, targeted, and interviewed by federal authorities. You can see her work and her images at arianadressler.com. That's ArianaDrehsler.com.
Ariana, I want to just express to you our gratitude because we agree with you. The story about the journalists is important, but the bigger story is this unfolding and dynamic human tragedy. And again, the terrible part of this human tragedy is that there isn't really a national emergency. You know, it's not an invading horde of people. These are desperate working folks who are trying to survive in the face of terrible problems that they're facing at home. And they have a legal right to come in and make an asylum claim.
And then they're separated from their children when they arrive.
Yeah, thousands of children also separated. Go ahead. We're about 1 minute left.
Yeah, I mean, the separation of families, that's just horrific, you know, and with the children endure, you know, the effects of being separated. I mean, I can't even fathom it. So, yeah, I'll just leave it there.
Okay, we will leave it there. We were joined from San Diego by Ariana Dressler, a photojournalist who recently completed a series on migrants and asylum seekers at the U.S.-Mexico border. She was targeted, tracked, and interviewed by federal authorities. You can see her work and images at arianadressler.com. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
President Trump yesterday issued an executive order revoking a requirement introduced at the end of the Obama administration to publicly report the number of U.S. drone strikes outside of war zones and the number of civilians killed by them. The Bureau of Investigative Journalism estimates that up to 1,700 civilians, including as many as 400 children, have been killed by U.S. drone bombing since the program began. We're joined from Tulsa, Oklahoma by Jeremy Kazmarov. He is a professor of American history whose latest book is The Russians Are Coming. Again, the first Cold War as tragedy, the second as farce. Welcome back, Jeremy.
Thanks.
Jeremy, what was the impetus for changing this this reporting requirement? Why is it better that Americans not know about civilian deaths from the drone program?
Well, it's better because Americans, if they knew the truth, I think many would be horrified. But I think this mode of warfare in general has been designed to distance the public from the atrocities that are carried out. I mean, these, you know, drones are, it's a highly imperfect technology, and, the targeting is often very inaccurate. The intelligence is often poor. Many civilians have been killed. It's inflamed local populations. And it's had a very adverse humanitarian effect, but they've been able to keep that, you know, more and more secret and distance it more and more from the public using this kind of technology and even evading reporting standards and criteria.
You know, the truth is, too, that before there was a reporting requirement, the Western press relied on the victims themselves and the press in places like Pakistan and Afghanistan and Yemen to talk about drone strikes. Americans didn't even know when there was a drone strike, but the locals certainly did.
And there's another element to this story, which I think people are not fully understanding, which is why did Obama and the Obama administration put this reporting requirement in place? Why did they do that? And again, John, as you said, it came towards the end of Obama's 8 years.
Right.
And you know, like Obama was known as the drone king, and he had meetings every Tuesday where they'd go through a kill list and decide who was going to be killed. That
John Brennan was in charge of the kill list.
Yeah, so they'd sit together and they'd go through a list and decide who lives, who dies. So then why did Obama do it? We want to talk about why Trump got rid of it, but why did Obama do it? The main reason that the Obama administration did it was because it was local media and not the U.S. government reporting on drone strikes. The argument was from the Pentagon and the Obama national security apparatus that the drone strikes were being used by America's quote unquote enemies to propagandize about how bestial and brutal and cruel and imperialistic the United States was. So by having a reporting mechanism, the Obama administration was trying to, in a way, get ahead of the story and say, well, whatever you're hearing from Al-Qaeda or this group or that group, wherever they were, you don't have to listen to them because we actually have an official recording. So it actually was part of drone warfare to make it more effective or to make the opponent's propaganda against the drone warfare less effective. Go ahead, Jeremy.
Yeah, that makes sense. And from what I've read, actually many of the high-value targets identified by the U.S. government were actually reported killed several times over.
Oh, yeah.
So it makes you question the data that they're putting out, how accurate it is. And I think they underestimated, the official numbers underestimated, because the Bureau of Investigative Journalism is a nonprofit organization that did some very good, digging into this and reporting. And I think they found that the Obama administration had underestimated civilian casualties by a huge number. So, that makes sense what you're saying. And a lot of the data was inaccurate that the U.S. government was putting forward. But that, the idea in principle, yeah, would be a good idea if the government could be relied upon and their data.
One thing that I want to go back, John, to where you started in a way. Because Americans don't know what it might feel like to live under a drone threat.
Yeah.
There are big parts of Somalia, of Yemen, of Pakistan, where these things are flying around.
They call them dragonflies in the Middle East because they buzz like a dragonfly does.
So you can hear them.
Yes.
From a long distance. But sometimes you can't see them, and sometimes you can see them.
But you can hear them.
You can hear them. And they're just flying and flying
in
and
circles,
buzzing.
Very slow circles.
Yeah.
But, in Yemen, they actually have lookouts now during funerals. Like, say there's a drone strike that kills a purported Al-Qaeda operative. The drone will be sent back to bomb the guy's funeral, to wipe out any other, supporters or friends or colleagues or whatever who might be attending the funeral. So they have to actually post lookouts to warn people if they can hear or see a drone to then disperse.
Yeah, and Jeremy, the point that you're making, the insidious character of this kind of warfare where people are living under, really, it's just a form of terrorism, right? I mean, you have to worry about when you're going to the wedding or a funeral or a family gathering, and you have these drone pilots sitting somewhere in Virginia pressing a button based on footage from thousands of miles away, and what? They decide to drop a Hellfire missile on a wedding party, and then what? They go home and have a couple beers?
Yeah.
I mean, that's insidious.
Absolutely, and I think, it started in the Vietnam era. They started to use a lot of drones in that war, because in that war, the soldiers and even the pilots were questioning what they were doing, and if they're coming face-to-face with the collateral damage, as the military calls it, anybody with a conscience feels bad. But if you're so far removed from the scene and the enemy is so demonized and dehumanized, it's just like playing a video game to them. And actually, I think the UN rapporteur, Philip Alston, undertook a report, and that's what he warned about, this kind of video game effect that makes going to war so easy and that there's not any second thought about it. And there was an excellent report called Living Under the Drones that was carried out by, I think it was a group of law professors that may have been Columbia or Stanford at NYU University, and they interviewed many people, like in Waziristan And they found, yeah, that whole communities were terrorized. Children were afraid to go to school. They were afraid to go in large groups. Many people just, you know, traumatized just living in fear because they didn't even see the drone in some cases. The missile just comes from the sky all of a sudden. So they're afraid it could strike at any moment. So it is a form of terrorism, and it generates more terrorists. Even the Defense Intelligence Agency released a report that found it creates many more terrorists than it purportedly kills. So there's really very limited value at all as a military tactic.
That's an important point.
Yeah.
It creates more terrorists than it kills.
Yeah. You know, one of the things about this reporting requirement, what we're talking about for our audience, we're talking to Jeremy Kuzmarov, historian, author, about the decision by Donald Trump to overturn through executive order the decision taken by the Obama administration to give what they said would be a transparent report about civilians who were killed by U.S. drones outside of battlefield, outside of designated war areas. The reason that's important is that Yemen and Somalia are designated war areas, right? And John, you were mentioning the other day that you were hearing reports that somebody was saying this: the Saudis were bombing people in Yemen with drones. And you said, wait.
The Saudis don't have drones.
So it's American drones.
It has to be. Well, that was in 2011. But yeah, that was a quick conclusion I came to.
And these areas, Yemen in particular, designated by the Obama administration to be war zones. And so the reporting didn't have to be about Yemen.
Well, the Washington Post makes an important point today, too, saying that the reason there's a difference between war zones and non-war zones is that in war zones, it's the Department of Defense that runs the drone program. In non-war zones, it's another separate government agency that runs the drone program.
Very, very interesting. Jeremy, 1 minute left. Take us out.
Well, I think this is a disturbing overreach of executive power. What we're seeing with the Trump administration is, you know, growing secrecy and the lack of transparency of the executive branch that could wage war wherever it wants without even reporting what the consequences are. So I think that's very disturbing. And it shows, yeah, Trump's rhetoric of isolationism is really a con.
It is indeed. We were happy to be joined from Tulsa, Oklahoma by Jeremy Kuzmarov. He is a professor of American history whose latest book is The Russians Are Coming Again. The first Cold War is tragedy, the second as farce. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We have more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. The Federal Reserve has decided to end some of the public pass-fail grades it gave big banks after their annual stress tests, which came as a result of the Dodd-Frank Act during the Great Recession. A bank will no longer receive a grade if it has taken the test for the past 4 years and passed in the most recent year, a move critics say raises the risk of another 2008-style financial collapse. We're joined from Malta by Brad Birkenfeld. He's a famed whistleblower who single-handedly brought down international money laundering at banking giant UBS. Welcome back, Brad.
Oh, thanks for having me on, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
Brad, why would the Fed do something like this now, just as we're beginning to see indications that the economy might be slowing down? Why would they deregulate?
You know, John, this is a really perplexing question because I think the problem is the relationship between the banking industry and the Fed. And I think the Federal Reserve has really, it's been so secretive and so non-transparent. And I think that's what really upsets people. Why would you make a decision like this? And it makes really no sense, quite frankly.
I'm looking at a piece in Fortune magazine, Brad, that was published today. And they're essentially saying the same thing that you're saying, that we had to go through the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. Dodd-Frank was a monumental piece of legislation. It's only 8 years old, 8.5 years old. So why now? It says here also, and I want you to comment on this, the Fed also voted against ordering banks to hold extra capital in case of a future downturn. Why would they do that? How does that help the bank? How does that help the consumer?
Well, I mean, the size of these banks today, because there's been a lot of acquisitions and mergers as a result of the financial crash, so these banks have gotten much bigger and, again, more risky, as we rightly saw in 2008 and 2009. So I think the other problem here is that there's even more reason why to hold more capital, more reason to have more regulation, because these banks continue to break the law, number one. No one really gets punished, and they just write a check, as we saw with the UBS case in particular, and many of these others with J.P. Morgan, Countrywide, and so forth. So I think the problem we have here is the Federal Reserve is really not capable to do this job. And people would be saying, well, how does this guy know this? Just look at the facts, just like you've outlined here. The facts remain that this organization, which acts in this sort of a vacuum, if you will, has made some the most egregious decisions over the last decades, and we're supposed to accept that as normal?
There's another piece that I'm looking at in one of the small publications that caters to the banking community. It says that Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, has shifted attention from individual non-bank financial firms, like AIG, for example, to market-wide risks. They want to look at the bigger picture. This is according to the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. But didn't we learn a lesson with AIG? This was a major non-bank financial firm that was one of the triggers of the 2008 crash and needed what was at the time the biggest federal bailout in American history. Why would we turn attention away from organizations or companies like AIG?
Well, this is the other thing, is that the close relationship between politicians and the Federal Reserve and banks is too close. We've said this before. We're going to say it again. You have to break this up where you do not have people so close to one another where they're getting a free pass. This is really the problem, and the American people are starting to say, why are we having to put up with this again, and why do we have to bear the burden of these stupid decisions that are made in Washington? And I think that's really the crux of the whole matter.
We're speaking with Brad Birkenfeld. He joins us from Malta. Brad is a famed whistleblower who single-handedly brought down international money laundering seriously at banking giant UBS. Brad, there's another issue at play here, too, and that is foreign banks. Now, this is where your expertise really comes into play. There have been loopholes in federal legislation, particularly in Dodd-Frank, that allowed some foreign banks to keep billions of dollars in assets away from U.S. bank regulators. So bank regulators here in the States didn't really know exactly how much money some of these major foreign banks had, even though they were doing business in the United States. The Fed is trying to tighten up some of these rules on foreign banks. Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? Or does that not matter to the average American consumer?
Well, I think it sets a very bad precedent. If you're not a standard, harmonized banking institution across all banks, because that means there's an unfair play there. Meaning you can have undisclosed reserves or off-balance sheet items and things like this. So those are really unfair tactics that certain banks can use. And then, of course, these banks use a lot of the fines they get paid to write them off as tax losses.
Right.
And then the taxpayer picks up that bill. So those kinds of things have to be addressed. And there's too many lobbyists trying to fight to keep those. And I would just say, no, those will not be allowed. We have to harmonize the banking industry and regulate it a bit more, because we really are going to face another problem in several years if we don't fix it now.
You know, there's a piece in Reuters today that I think you'd probably get a kick out of. It says that this effort to tighten regulations on foreign banks is particularly a blow for UBS, your former bank, Credit Suisse, and Deutsche Bank. They have billions and billions of dollars in assets, like corporate loans, at their New York branches that, because of these loopholes, have not been declared to U.S. bank regulators. It says that this will inflame tensions between European regulators and American regulators, because the Europeans have complained for years that their lenders are held to a higher standard in the U.S. than U.S. banks are. Is that true? Or are foreign banks held to the same standard as American banks?
Well, there are different standards here. There's different accounting standards. GAAP, of course, GAAP, is not recognized in some of the Swiss banks. So you have some of these accounting reporting requirements that are not the same. So how can you possibly have banks playing on the same level playing field? They can't. So really what you must have is a global system, and the Bank of International Settlements is in Switzerland, and you have all of this offshore money that was in Switzerland. They seem to get different kinds of rules for what they want to do vis-a-vis the rest of the world. So I think really what has to come down to this is everyone has to agree on the same standard so that everyone understands that everyone's playing by the same rules. Otherwise, it's just not a fair game.
Brad, the New York Times said recently that after you brought down money laundering and made it so much more difficult for foreign banks to launder money, especially money of American citizens, the only places remaining where a person could launder money, illegally gotten money, drug money, etc., was in real estate and in fine art. Is that true? Or is there still money laundering taking place through banks?
Well, there is. I mean, I think what you see now is the United States has really made a dent in Switzerland, thanks to my efforts and my historic whistleblowing. But more importantly, the U.S. has now become the new offshore haven. There's only two countries in the world who do not exchange information with other countries on their citizens. That's Panama and the United States. So
oh,
if
boy.
The French ask about French citizens in America, America won't answer. But if America asks about Americans to the French, they have to give the information. So this is really an absolute con game. The American banks are getting away with this, and it's really quite bad because you've got the lawyers, the bankers, the accountants, the politicians all playing this game. And it's really, it's dreadful for the American people because now what you have is artwork, real estate, as you rightly point out, yachts and motor yachts. These kinds of things are just, they turn a blind eye to it. And this is very, very scary. And a lot of the structures that are done in the states, meaning Delaware and Nevada and so forth, where you set up these LLCs, they're really invisible. You can't really see what's going on in there. So I tell you, this is a very dangerous game, and the U.S. is unfortunately a big player of this offshore world now.
So that points to the importance of the whistleblower, the anonymous whistleblower who revealed the Panama Papers. I didn't realize that Panama and the United States were the only countries that didn't share banking information on their own citizens. So there were all these different foreign nationals, very prominent ones, political leaders and prominent bankers and businessmen who had secret accounts in Panama. A whistleblower there who has never been identified released that information to the media, and now we know who has what where.
Well, this is it. And the problem is that, as I said, the automatic exchange of information, which was forced upon Switzerland, has now been put in place with over 100 countries worldwide, meaning they exchange information when the governments ask for that for their citizens. And America and Panama are the only two that do not subscribe to this. This is an absolute fallacy. It's such a farce. The fact that all of this information about offshore banking was given to them on a silver platter, and now they take advantage of it and use it to their own benefit. And this is not right for the rest of the world.
Brad, in our last minute, I want to ask you about something that that the White House released today. They said that the president directed the Treasury Department to deregulate because it's a reflection of the strength of our economy. And the White House statement from this morning said that deregulation was a top priority, along with tax cuts and trade agreements, overhauling these trade agreements, because those are the three keys to accelerating economic growth. Do you think that this deregulation accelerates economic growth?
Well, I haven't looked at the deregulation that the White House has proposed, and I believe in tax cuts, and I believe in trade agreements. Those are very important. And a lot of people try to give it sort of the bad sign that, oh, my goodness, you're giving to the rich tax cuts. No, it's actually tax cuts for everyone. Now, of course, it's going to be at a different scale depending upon your income. But the point being is tax cuts give people more money, and they invest that money. They spend it. So that keeps the economy moving much, much quicker. Trade agreements, clearly, America has suffered a lot to foreign countries that took advantage of trade agreements. And I think President Trump is doing a good job with this to address those. Now, deregulation, that's another thing that's very dangerous.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen the particulars of the deregulation. And I think it's generally bad because the banks never learned their lesson from 2008.
Yeah.
So why would we do that? So that one I would sort of say is a question mark, but certainly lowering taxes, tax cuts, as well as trade agreements are a very good thing for America.
Okay, we will leave it there. We were joined from Malta by Brad Birkenfeld. He's a famed whistleblower who single-handedly brought down international money laundering at banking giant UBS. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
It's time again for our regular weekly segment, Veterans for Peace, where we'll discuss contemporary issues of war and peace that affect veterans, their families, and the country as a whole. We're joined every week from California by Jerry Condon. He's a Vietnam-era veteran and war resister who has been a peace and solidarity activist for almost 50 years, currently as the national president of Veterans for Peace. Welcome back, Jerry.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Jerry, let's start off by talking a little bit about nuclear issues. I was reminded this past week when we saw India and Pakistan come to blows of when I was stationed in Pakistan in 2002. One day I went to lunch with a young CIA officer. We went to the cafeteria. The cafeteria is so enormous, it probably holds 300 people. We were the only people in it at high noon. And she asked me, "Where is everybody?" And I said, "They've been evacuated." And she said, "Why?" And I said, "Don't you read the papers? We're on the brink of nuclear war with India." And sure enough, that afternoon, the Deputy Secretary of State flew in, Rich Armitage, and shuttled back and forth between Islamabad and Delhi and got both sides to back down. The thing is that this happens every couple of years between India and Pakistan. It happened again this week. Talk about that.
Right. Well, it's very scary. I mean, people, first of all, you know, people are, generally speaking, not really very aware, or mm-hmm. there's no real public discourse about the danger of nuclear war. And I think, you know, a lot of people are focused on the dangers of climate change, which are very, very real, and also another existential threat. But people aren't talking about nuclear, the possibility of nuclear war. And I think a lot of young people especially are not very aware of those dangers. They didn't live through that period of the Cold War where we were also worried about nuclear war. But the situation in general is scarier than ever. I mean, more countries have nuclear weapons. We are not living in a peaceful world. I'm sure you've noticed that. And yeah, what happened with India, you know, people don't think about India and Pakistan themselves. There was a study done fairly recently that showed that a limited nuclear war between India and Pakistan would cause some level of nuclear winter.
Yes.
In the world, and could lead to massive famine and possibly the deaths of billions of people just from a limited nuclear exchange. Like, I don't know exactly the number, but if India and Pakistan traded several dozen nuclear weapons, that would be a huge threat to the entire world, and it's a very real possibility.
There was news this week also that the Saudi government is seeking nuclear technology ostensibly for power because they don't have oil in that part of the world. And, you know, the conventional wisdom, of course, is that the Saudis want the nuclear technology so that they can build a bomb. There have been rumors since the 1980s that the Saudis have wanted a bomb, and rumors that they even engaged at one point in the 1990s, AQ Khan, who's the father of the Pakistani nuclear program. What are you hearing about
right.
Saudi Arabia?
Well, I just think it's really alarming that Saudi Arabia, which is, you know, a fundamentalist monarchy, if there ever was something that truly was a dictatorship, that's it, and a brutal one to be sure, who, you know, beheads anybody who dares to dissent, and that has been the funder and enabler and inspiration for multiple jihadi terrorist groups, Al Qaeda, ISIS, etc., and for the prospect of that regime getting nuclear technology, which no doubt they would try to transfer into nuclear weapons, very, very scary indeed. So that's what I'm basically what I'm saying is the continuing proliferation of nuclear technology and nuclear weapons around the world at a time when the United States, the big dog in the world, is just creating more and more tension and not leading in a peaceful direction at all. I mean, the United Nations General Assembly, to their credit, did last year or the year before pass the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons by, I think, 122 countries signed on to that. and now it's in the process of being ratified by countries around the world. I mean, South Africa, which was a former nuclear power, actually, was the most recent country to ratify that treaty. I think they're the 21st country, and after 50 countries do, it will become international law. So there are trends, you know, worldwide. The people of the world and most of the countries of the world, want nuclear disarmament, and they want to get rid of the threat of nuclear war. However, the 9 nuclear powers who have the nuclear weapons or have not signed on to that, and they're very jealous of that nuclear weapon. Some like North Korea feel they need it for their defense, and others, of course, like the U.S. and the imperial powers, want to use it to continue their domination of the globe. So we have a real problem and a real challenge, and I think we have to come up with new strategies for building popular resistance and finally to dramatically reduce the risk of nuclear war and eventually to eliminate all nuclear weapons.
Jerry, you've been writing recently about the issue of nuclear war. Can you tell us a little bit about what you are saying there? I know that you've been talking about the Nuclear Forces Treaty, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, and mm-hmm. a couple of other issues related to weapons. Tell us about that.
Pretty much what we've been talking about. I mean, I think, you know, there's a number of other very concerning things. The fact that that President Trump and his neocon advisors have pulled the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal, and they're pressuring other countries to do the same, while nuclear-armed Israel and the neocons here are beating the drums for war with Iran. That's a very, very real threat, and an immediate one. They pretty much telegraphed that they want to go to war with Iran, and they're working towards that end. Failure so far of the U.S. and North Korea to agree to a formula for denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, which would involve, of course, denuclearizing some of the U.S. nukes as well. That has not has so far not getting very far. Although I must say that the Veterans for Peace and many people in the peace movement are still cautiously optimistic and encouraging those negotiations to continue. And then I just think in general that the U.S. military posture worldwide and the U.S. and NATO continuing to threaten Russia on its very borders, that's like tempting a nuclear war in Europe. So they're pushing things to the limit in way too many places, very, very reckless. And, you know, I would say, you know, if there's not some kind of dramatic reversal of this militarism, and especially the nuclear militarism, then it's almost inevitable that there will be a nuclear war, and maybe more than one. We have been extremely fortunate not to have had a nuclear war since the U.S. dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki to get through the Cold War. But we now know that was not because of the wise policy of mutually assured destruction, which is a criminally insane policy. But it's because of a lot of amazing good luck, miracles almost, where officers, including some Soviet officers, were on the verge of pushing the button in response to U.S. moves. There were false information of incoming nukes, and people were ready to respond. And actually, people in some cases disobeyed orders because they didn't want to take the risk that they were wrong. And it turned out that they were very right in doing so. So at any rate, we've been lucky, and we can't count on that luck. We have to build a really strong movement, especially here in the United States, which holds most of the nuclear weapons in the world.
That's the voice of Jerry Condon. He is currently national president of Veterans for Peace. This segment called Veterans for Peace airs every Thursday here on Loud and Clear, talking about countries at the brink. The Trump administration is pushing Venezuela to the brink. Jerry, you've been writing about it, talking about it. I know Veterans for Peace is working with a number of us here in Washington, mm-hmm. D.C. Mm-hmm. for what will be, I think, a very significant mass action on Saturday, March 16th at the White House, saying no to sanctions on Venezuela, self-determination, and also no new war on Venezuela because the coup isn't going so good. That's Trump's coup and Bolton's coup. Mm-hmm. And the danger of a military intervention is real, given how many times the U.S. has militarily intervened in Latin America. We have about 30 seconds left. Take us out on that, if you would.
Yeah, well, I think it's the coup is the attempted coup by the U.S. And its allies is ongoing. And we kind of are breathing a little bit easier because it seems like the Venezuelan people are standing with the government. Even those who are critical of the government don't want to see a U.S. Military intervention or any other kind of intervention by the U.S., so-called humanitarian intervention. The protests around the world have been strong. The mass media information continues. It's just horribly one-sided. And yet, through various alternative media, I think there's been quite a bit of exposure of the falseness, the fraud of so-called humanitarian intervention, and the fact that obviously the U.S. wants Venezuela's oil is pretty transparent, as well as to overturn any kind of moves towards socialism in Latin America.
Indeed.
So, yeah, we're very excited about the march and rally on March 16th in Washington, D.C. Veterans for Peace will be there. Also in L.A., we're going to also be in D.C. on March 30th for another set of anti-war demonstrations. And ongoing. This is very important that we stay vigilant.
It is.
And focused. Be in solidarity with the people of Venezuela.
That was the voice of Jerry Condon, who joined us from California. He is a Vietnam-era veteran and war resister who has been a peace and solidarity activist for almost 50 years, currently as the national president of Veterans for Peace. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.